Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light, and my guest today is Terry Daniel, and she is an author of a book called A Swan in Heaven, Conversations Between Two Worlds, and it is written from her perspective as a mother who communicates telepathically with her son, who died at the age of 16 from a rare degenerative disorder. And I have to say that what surprises me, and we will talk about this with Terry, is that he started to make contact with her within a very brief time after his death. So we hear of many stories of contact with people on the other side, but it seems occasionally there's one that is quite different. Welcome to the program, Terry.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
You're welcome. We're looking forward to this. Now, what makes your contact with your son unique?
Well, it's actually different than it was when it started 3 years ago after he died. What makes it unique, I think, is because he's actually working with me as a guide. And we all have guides, of course, in the higher realms to work with us, but most of the time they are not people that we've actually known in physical life. So what's kind of unique about this situation is that he has been a guide and a teacher to me and with me for many incarnations and came in as my son in this incarnation, to manifest the work that we're now doing. So that's kind of unusual, as I understand it, in the world of channeling, that you would actually channel somebody and work with them as a guide, somebody who's actually been incarnated with you in such a close relationship.
Yes, I'm sure that's generally true. Did you believe in after-death communication and everything else that goes with it before you began communicating with your son?
I did, but not nearly as much as I do now. I was always intuitive and metaphysically minded, but it wasn't a big part of my life. And then when he was diagnosed with his illness, I had to make some sort of sense of it, and I knew immediately that it couldn't just be a random event that had no meaning. It was very clear that there was a very big purpose to having this child with this disease that would be degenerative, and he would eventually die before he reached adulthood. And I just knew immediately that there was a bigger purpose here. And I did believe in after-death communication. I believed in all of this, but those ideas and beliefs were enhanced. Once I realized he was going to die, I started studying and meditating and working to open that conduit. And during the last 3 years of his life, we sort of did that together. During those last 3 years, he wasn't really verbal. He couldn't talk anymore. Mm-hmm. And I taught him how to meditate, and we did guided visualizations and a lot of processes that I think had a lot to do with establishing the connection that we have now.
Right. What were the circumstances in which the first contact was made after he passed over?
Well, it was really beautiful. It was 30 minutes after he died, and I was lying down next to him, next to his body, holding him in my arms. And I said, show me where you are right now. And I really didn't expect anything to happen, because from what I had studied, people don't usually make contact that quickly after they die. But instantly, he showed me a very comical picture of himself, standing, looking, you know, tall, and he looked about 20 years old. He was 16 when he died, but he looked about 20 in this vision. And he was walking around in about an inch of water, like in the ocean, and kicking the water around and laughing. And I was utterly astonished. I saw this vision so clearly, and we began to talk immediately. And I said, is this real? Am I really seeing you? And he said, this is absolutely real. We have been preparing for this, and you will always see me this easily, as long as your conduit is not cluttered up with doubt and fear and all that nasty human stuff that gets in the way.
Right. Now, I understand that you lead guided meditations and other processes designed to open the conduit for other people. What is the type of meditation you use?
Well, I do several different meditations. It depends on the circumstances. I do a lot of work with grief groups, specifically parents who've had children die. And I do a very gentle guided meditation for beginners, because a lot of these people aren't even sure they believe in it. A lot of them have resistance because of their religious beliefs. So I don't force them into it too harshly. So, you know, my very simple beginning meditation is basically getting them to begin with some deep breathing, to imagine seeing their loved one's face in front of them, and a technique where you imagine looking at your loved one as if you're looking right into their eyes, and imagine that they are breathing, and watch and feel their breathing, like their chest is going up and down as they breathe, and synchronize your breathing with theirs, so that the two of you are looking eye to eye and you're breathing in sync. This is one of the first techniques. And
that
in doing this... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that sounds very interesting. I haven't heard that type of approach before. In fact, I was doing it with you as you went along.
Oh, were you? Yes. It's very easy to go along with,
yes,
because you're
yes,
used to looking at that person that way when they were alive.
Yes.
So it's a very natural thing to do. And then once you go into that synchronized breathing, you really feel their presence. At this point, everybody is feeling it, and people are crying, and their hearts are opening, and it's just quite beautiful. And then we just go a little bit deeper, and we ask them to just listen. What is this loved one saying to you? What is the message that they're sending? And people will usually get, you know, the usual things of, I love you, don't worry, I'm fine. And that's good, because that's all true. But then as we continue deeper into the meditation, we get more specific messages. And I always have people keep a pen and paper with them and write while they're doing the meditation. So they end up doing a kind of automatic writing
as these
imprints are coming to them.
Right. Now, apart from trying to contact someone specifically, like one of your loved ones or friends, you tell us that the energies include our own inner voices or higher selves, and also guidance from angels, spirit guides, etc. Now, how do people distinguish the difference between those?
That's a very good question. Well, certainly you recognize your loved one because you know their energy. And they may not even look like the body they had in this incarnation, but if you are contacting your grandmother or your father or somebody who's died, you'll recognize them immediately because you know them. You know that energy. You've been with that energy for many incarnations. So that's usually pretty easy. Recognizing spirit guides is easy, too, because you may notice that you've never seen this person before. You don't know who this is. You might have a vision where, you know, a tall man with blonde hair comes walking towards you. You recognize them by their love and by their energy, because when we're relating with other beings in non-physical realms, it doesn't have anything to do with the bodies or the visual. It's completely energetic. And you recognize them by their feelings, or by what they feel like. So you may not have ever seen a particular guide before, at least not that you're aware of, but you'll recognize the energy of that guide because they've been with you all your life and in many lifetimes.
Yeah. Would you say that you would know if you saw angels, because would they appear in a way that you might say is traditional and appear to have wings?
Well, you know, what people get, and this happens with near-death experiences too, as I'm sure you know, is you will get, when you're starting out, images that fit with what you believe. So people who have near-death experiences, for example, who believe in, you know, the Christian traditional version of heaven will see angels with wings. They'll see pearly gates and golden streets and angelic choirs and all of that stuff. When you first start venturing into these realms, the angels and the guides will make it palatable to you. They'll give you something that you understand. That will change as you continue to work in those realms. But for many people, they'll get what's familiar. And in, I guess it's, is it Raymond Moody who wrote Life After Life? I can't remember. But in one of those books where they studied near-death experiences, children who died and came back, who did not have any religious indoctrination at all, who just weren't, you know, raised with any religion, would see Disney characters because that's what was comforting and familiar to them. So they'd go and they'd leave their bodies and they'd see Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck or somebody. And eventually they'll see their guides, but just as a welcoming committee, they sort of show up in whatever form is comfortable for you.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that about Mickey Mouse, because I was reading a book just recently that said that when you give these type of cartoon characters, if you like, energy and you believe in them, they start to become a thought form and have their own sort of existence. So I can totally agree with what you just said. And incidentally, you were correct about the book. I've read the Raymond Moody book about Life After Life, and he's very good in that area of our of out of the body experiences. So yeah,
he's a pediatrician, isn't he?
Hey, Tom.
I think, is he a pediatrician, or am I confused? No, that's Raymond Morse. That's somebody else. I get them confused.
Right. Yeah, I wasn't sure about that one.
But that's interesting what you said about the cartoon characters, because think about it this way: they originated as a thought form in somebody's imagination.
Yes.
So, of course they are forms, yeah.
Well, you can imagine with children seeing Walt Disney films, the animals like Bambi and such obviously exist if they want to see them.
Well, they're all expressions of the collective mind, aren't they? You know, so all the creations that we can come up with, art and music and Disney characters, are all expressions from the one, one collective mind. And they represent inner archetypes. You know, Bambi is the inner archetype of the innocent child that is pure love. And then there's the archetype of the mother, you know, Bambi's mother. And then there's the hunter is an archetype of an aspect of ourselves that kill people.
Very
I mean,
true.
It's all archetypal.
Yeah. Now, you said that this gift of contact with these energies is our birthright. So I guess you believe that this type of contact is possible with anyone who puts their mind to it.
I do believe that, absolutely. And you'll find that almost everybody who's had a death of somebody close to them has had some sort of contact. They just don't believe it when it happens. You hear so many stories about how, you know, they walked into a store and heard the person's favorite song playing on the music system, and it's a rare song that you would not normally hear in a store, or all these things. You know, so many stories of finding pennies on the street because the person always liked to collect pennies. I mean, I've heard millions of them. So most people have had contact and don't acknowledge it or allow it to be true.
Yes. So these little events are set up so that you get some sort of proof and you connect it with someone who has passed over. It's very subtle and also very clever, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a very nice system, isn't it? It's like a trail of breadcrumbs.
You know,
it's kind of
yes.
like, here's a little trail, you can follow it if you want to, I'm right here.
Absolutely,
and,
And
when I talk to these groups of bereaved parents, I spoke to a group in Kentucky in the southern United States, which is traditionally a very right-wing, conservative, Christian part of the country, And I was a little nervous about talking to these folks because I didn't know if I would offend their religious sensibilities. And I asked them right in the beginning of my talk, how many of you have had some sort of contact from your child, either in dreams or visions or coincidences? And every single hand in the room went up. It always does. So their minds are open to it, even though their culture may tell them it's not possible.
Well, that's good to hear, because you mentioned yourself something that's obviously true, that a lot of people believe that the transmission of divine messages stopped after the Bible was written. And, of course, that doesn't really make any sense, does it, to be honest?
Do people really believe that? I mean, that would certainly seem, what the belief is. But I think when you scratch the surface, it just doesn't even seem possible that anybody could really believe that. But yet that is pretty much the doctrine, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, that.
I mean, to believe that, that you believe in God in the first instance and then are prepared to accept that he has, if you like, in a manner of speaking, no further interest in your evolution, it doesn't really come over correct, does it?
No, it really doesn't. But then, the interesting thing about all those ideas is I'm in school right now working on a divinity degree, and I am studying the Gnostic Gospels, which are the ancient books that were discovered in 1945, and they are the earliest Christian writings which were banned by the Orthodox Church when the Church was being formed. And if you read these early writings, it's nothing like what we've all been taught as the Bible. It's completely different. And in these teachings, it's very comfortable with the fact that the divine is communicating with us at all times, that we are so connected to the divine and so much a part of it, there's no separation at all. And so originally, in the original teachings, we were allowed to talk to God, and God was allowed to talk back to us. But that all got removed when the Church started organizing.
Yeah. Are you going back to the period when, as far as I know, the Bible was put together by Emperor Constantine? Is that where you're going back to?
Well, actually, it was put together before that.
It was
put together beginning with Paul. I mean, 100 years after Christ, because people were writing about all of this. You know, there was a group of Christians called the Gnostics, and they had taken the teachings of Jesus as they heard them, because it was all handed down by word of mouth, and began writing about it. And these are the early writings that I'm talking about. By the time it got to Constantine, a couple hundred years later, these books had all been discarded and new books were written, and what Constantine did was organize it even more formally to suit his agenda. But it had already been sifted through pretty well by then.
Yes. I have read some of the background to that period, and evidently he took what was described as the best parts of lots of different religious beliefs at that time to make up what we come to know as the Bible. So in some respects, you have to say it's a little bit dubious. But nevertheless, it does carry a message that people can find in there. But I guess you now have to have a more open mind if you're going to evolve a little bit further.
Of course. I mean, that's what it's all about, is have an open mind and evolve further, isn't it? When I talk to traditional religious thinkers, they will actually, I think a famous televangelist, I believe it was Bob Shuler, when was asked about these discoveries in the 1940s of these hidden books, and he said, well, I don't really care about that. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are good enough for me. So that's kind of like, I don't want to learn anything else. I want to just stick with what's familiar. I don't care how much evidence there is that there's more to it than I think. I'm not going to go there. And that's what most people think.
Yeah, well, if it suits them, it's obviously right for them at the time. And you clearly feel like I do, that we must allow other people to follow their own path, wherever that leads.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned, in addition to the guides that we can contact, those that broadcast to us, as you call it, via symbols and images. Now, what have you come across where they have used symbols? I mean, how do they use that?
Oh, that's a great question. You have to realize that they don't communicate in words like we have, and they communicate basically in energy patterns and thought forms. And so when someone is channeling, what you receive is not necessarily words. You receive imprints, is really the best way that I can describe it. I receive thoughts that are put in my head, and they feel like they're my thoughts. And the more I do this, the more my thoughts and the information being sent to me kind of merges, so I can't even tell them apart anymore. But sometimes they'll communicate in symbols, and this is really simple. It's like, how many times have you been somewhere where somebody gives you a book that's exactly the right book that you need to read at this time to deal with something in your life? That's the way, one way that they communicate with us. Or they'll send us a song, or they'll send us an event or a person. So these are all kind of symbolic messages. Or, I get these in a very silly way. This is a silly little story, but my mother lives in a retirement community where the people drive around in these little golf carts. You know
what
I'm talking about?
When
my son Danny was little, he had a habit of, when he was about seven, before he got sick, he would always go in the garage, he'd steal the key to the golf cart and start it up and try to drive it. He was only 7 years old. It was quite dangerous. Mm-hmm. And he would do this every chance he got. And it became a big joke in our family, you know, that Danny was stealing the golf cart. Well, just this last year, on the third-year anniversary of Danny's death, my mother was somewhere at a shopping mall, and a place where she goes all the time, and she saw a golf cart there that was not one of the usual ones that she always sees. It was different than the others. It was painted red or something, and the license plate said, Danny's Car. So we thought this was hilarious. You know, this was a symbol that Danny gave her on his death anniversary just to show that he's paying attention, you know, that he's there.
Amazing.
And so So it's like that.
How do they manage it?
Well, because, you know, all energy is connected to all other energy. So whoever that person is who drove that golf cart, whose name is obviously Danny, somehow, on some level, his soul and his guides and my mother's soul and her guides and all the helpers aligned at the right moment to bring that man in his golf cart to that parking lot at that moment. I mean, it really does work that way. And I often say in my workshops that all of every living life form and every thought form is interconnected like pieces in a kaleidoscope. So if you look at a kaleidoscope and you turn it just one teeny little click, all the pieces rearrange into a different structure. And this is happening every second in the universe. And so whoever that man is with that golf cart who drove into the parking lot that day, you know, something nudged something in the universe that caused him to say, I'm going to go drive my golf cart to the store right now, at the same time that my mother happened to be there, and so on and so on. All the pieces are connected and work together. There are no coincidences.
No, and what is more amazing is that all over the world, these type of coincidences, as we shouldn't call them, are taking place, aren't they?
Always.
Amazing, yes.
And so everything that happens, I'm sorry, go on.
No, carry on. You said always, yes.
Well, just that everything that happens for a reason. It's all part of it's all part of creation, is a word I'm fond of using these days. You know, and this way it helps us to get over grief and pain. So if I'm working with someone who is having a traumatic experience, let's say their child died, perhaps in a car crash with a drunk driver. I run into that a lot. And these parents are just, they're traumatized beyond imagining how much pain they're in. And when you can begin to see this kaleidoscope effect of the world, you move out of your little personal ego-dominated space, and you can see the oneness. And when you see the oneness and the interconnectedness, it helps quite a bit to relieve that pain. And you realize, well, then maybe there was a reason why my child was in that car crash or was hit by a drunk driver, and the drunk driver and the other cars and the other people in the cars were all part of the arrangement of pieces.
Yes.
On the kaleidoscope.
Well, as you say, there is really, in that sense, any major happening in your life has to have been planned. It is not a coincidence, and it is not just a lucky or unlucky occurrence, is it?
Absolutely. And the thing with planning, and everyone asks me this all the time, well, if everything is planned, then can we change it? And the answer is absolutely, it changes all the time. The changing is also part of the structure. So if I change my mind about something, if I call you and I say, well, you know, Mike, I can't do the interview today. I have to cancel. So I've changed something. And then you find somebody else to do the interview today, and whoever was tuning in to listen to me accidentally has to listen to somebody else. That's not an accident.
Yeah.
So the free will, every little change, also moves the kaleidoscope.
Yes, yes. I think you hit on a point there. And also believe, and I'm sure you do, that the plans are made before we incarnate. So we've exercised our free will at that point to establish our life plan. But nevertheless, we still hold that choice of free will or free will choice even so.
Yes. I mean, the free will is always there. And one of the things that gets people a little confused about this is if you say, well, okay, I have a life plan. I'm going to come into incarnation in 1953 in America as a female, blah, blah, whatever the pieces are. And if one believes that there is the concept of time, then it's really hard to understand that the free will can change the plan. You come in to learn certain lessons, and you don't have to learn them all in this incarnation, but that idea of a time limit is what really trips people up, because they say, well, if you came in to learn a lesson about greed, and you come in as a very poor person or a very rich person, and you change your mind, well, then when are you going to learn that lesson? How can you change your mind if that was your plan? And the answer is, you'll learn it next time, because there's no time. This is an endless cycle. We have all the time we need. So you can decide not to learn a certain lesson or not to deal with a certain experience and come back to it later. And you'll come back to it later with more knowledge and more experience.
In other words, you can take on as little or as much as you wish.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Now,
that certainly makes existence seem a lot easier, doesn't it?
Oh, of course, yes. Indeed. But it's surprising, incidentally, how many people I speak to, I mean, they might not have our understanding or belief, who have no idea what the purpose of their life is.
I think that would be most people. And so then they might say, well, how do I know what the purpose of my life is? And that's a reasonable question. And I think the answer to that is the only way to really tap into your own soul and your own higher self is through meditation.
Mm.
And you can
yes.
get that through journaling. There are a lot of processes, a lot of ways to do it.
Yes. Do you actually teach such people to ask for the information, because I believe there's a situation where if you don't ask, in a manner of speaking, you don't get. It always pays you to ask for the help you want.
That's exactly correct. And I think what confuses a lot of people is they're not sure who they're asking. And most of us were taught that there's this thing called God, and it is separate from us, and it's kind of humanoid, and it can bestow things upon us. It can, you know, give us happy times and bad times, and that we're supposed to ask God to please help us find someone to love, or to please heal our cancer, or to please help us get a job. And we have this infantile notion of God as an authority figure. It's like God is our mommy who's going to make us feel all better if we fall down and skin our knee. You know, it is really an infantile kind of notion. And this is not who we're supposed to ask. We're not asking a separate being that lives somewhere in the universe separate from us to do us a favor and help us out. What we are asking is our own soul, the part of us that had the free will decision to cause us to come to Earth in the first place, but we're not, once we get to Earth, we're not in touch with that. So we're asking our own soul, but we're also asking the collective, we're asking the kaleidoscope, which includes our guides and all the people who are connected to us, the people in our soul family. We're asking the energy of creation that works with our own soul to manifest a particular event.
Yes, yes. Now, since your son died, you've obviously learned a tremendous amount about the way spirit operates, etc. But prior to that, did you have any sort of conversation telepathically with your son so that you could prepare him for death? Because you must have known that he would probably die early.
You mean prior to his, you mean after he was diagnosed and I knew in the physical world that he would die, or do you mean prior to this incarnation?
Well, yes, after he was diagnosed, yes.
After he was diagnosed. Yes and no. I did not. When he was 10 when he was diagnosed, and when he was 10, he was still somewhat normal, and I did not want to tell him, you're going to die in 5 years, because I didn't want him to be scared or sad and spend the short bit of his life worrying about death. So rather than just tell him that right off the bat, I decided I would educate him about a different view of death. I realized that as an American child, the only death he ever heard about was what he saw on television and video games and movies. Nobody in our life had ever died, no relatives, no pets. He'd never been exposed to death, which is very common in the modern world. And what he thought death was, you know, it was bad guys on TV shooting each other. So what death was in his mind and in the mind of most modern children is this violent, irrational, gory experience. So I started going to the library and getting books from other cultures, Buddhist books about death and Native American books, and books that could be read to a child. And I started reading him different creation myths and death stories from different cultures that were not the American Judeo-Christian one, and started talking to him about other worlds and about death, and how death is just like going to sleep, and then you wake up, and you're somewhere else. And when you're in this other place, you can still see this world, and you can see many other worlds as well, and you have the ability to move among them. And so I spent a couple of years kind of indoctrinating him into this different view of death, and I always thought he was laughing at me, because he probably knew way more about all of this than I did. And I really think that that teaching, that training, had a lot to do with allowing us the communication that we have now. And I realize now that I was really training myself, because I believe he already knew all of this already.
Now, you said that he actually guided you to publish his words in a book. I mean, what did he actually exactly convey to you so that you understood that?
Well, he didn't convey that to me when he was alive. He conveyed that to me afterwards, and that didn't come only from him. During the last year of his life, I had a lot of readings with my friend Rebecca Covington, who is a remarkable channeler, And can I give out her website address? Am I allowed to do that?
Yes, quite
it's RebeccaCovington.com. And she's my teacher and my channeler. And so the guides that she channels, her guides, have been working with me. I've been having readings with her for 10 years. And so they've been really supporting me and helping me through the whole illness and death of Danny, and they know us pretty well. And they're the ones who first told me that I should write a book and that I should start taking notes of all the things that I experienced in meditation, all my visions and my dreams, everything connected to this journey with Danny, because I would not remember it if I didn't. So I started doing that probably about 3 months before he died. And that became the beginning of the book. And then after he died, because at this point, before he died, he couldn't talk. But after he died is when it came very clear to me, you know, he would say to me, he'd show me all these visions and give me all this information and say, this is going in our book. This is for the book, the book, the book, the book. So now we're on our second book.
Oh, wonderful. Now, you mentioned Rebecca. In fact, I interviewed her in February, and I can't remember the precise details, but it is a name that I recall tells me it was a very extremely interesting interview.
Mm-hmm. So she's an extraordinary teacher. She really, really, she's the real thing. She's great.
Yeah. Now, you also speak in connection with the power of meditation about teaching people forgiveness. Now, I think that's a very important thing on our spiritual journey. How do you put it over to people in the sense that they need to do that and the value of it if they're going to advance spiritually?
Mm-hmm. Well, the biggest issue with forgiveness is that people have a notion of what it is, and that notion is impossible to do. Everybody talks about forgiveness. Jesus talks about forgiveness. New Age people, psychology, everyone talks about forgiveness. But has anybody ever given us any techniques? How do you actually forgive? And before you can get the techniques, you have to change your understanding of what forgiveness is. And this is a great question, because I'm starting a new workshop on Sunday about forgiveness. Most people think that forgiveness means tolerance and condoning. And the biggest issue with forgiveness that everybody always brings up, they always say, well, can we forgive a monster like Adolf Hitler? So now Hitler is my poster boy for forgiveness. So let's use Hitler as an example. And so can we forgive Hitler? Well, it depends what we think forgiveness is. So there's, I've identified, my guides have showed me, four different levels of understanding forgiveness. Level one, which is where most people are, is it means forgiveness condones his behavior. If I forgive Hitler, that means I've accepted what he did, and I can never accept that, so I can never forgive. And that's where most people are stuck. So now there's another second level, level two, where it's not about condoning behavior, but it's about releasing the part of you where you hold that pain inside you. So if you take a Holocaust survivor, their whole life is wrapped around that pain, and it lives now inside of their soul and their heart and their body, and they're holding that. So level two of forgiveness is to release it out of yourself. It's no longer about what we think about Hitler. It's about how do we heal what's inside of us. Carolyn Mace, one of my favorite teachers, says refusing to forgive somebody is like taking poison and hoping the other person will die. Mm-hmm. And that's what level two is like. It's like you've taken this poison and it's poisoning you, so you release it from yourself. Level three is the next highest step of understanding forgiveness, where you realize that Hitler is just another piece in the kaleidoscope, and that all of humanity is made up of these little pieces that move together in a direction toward love. But in order to do that, there has to be balance. There has to be a positive and negative charge, like a battery. has a positive and negative. So all these so-called bad things that have happened in the world are part of this mass movement toward growth. So now we can release our judgments about Hitler because we see him as part of the kaleidoscope, and he, in this sense, is no different than you and me because all we're right. all connected to this oneness. And so that's level three. And then ultimately that leads to something that nobody would ever associate with Hitler, and that's gratitude, level four. And what is the gratitude for? Because we have recognized our place in the oneness, and we no longer see ourselves as separate from anything else. And we have gratitude for recognition of how that works. We have gratitude for understanding love and spirit and oneness. So that's my whole forgiveness seminar.
That's very good. And do you also think that there is a level here, I don't know where it comes in yours, where you recognize that every soul comes from what some people call the Godhead and therefore contains the light? So they are every bit in that sense a soul exactly like you.
Exactly. And that fits with level three of my scenario, is where you recognize that there is no separation. I came across a wonderful word that really expressed it. In fact, when I was reading one of these Gnostic Gospels, and the word is emanations. We are emanations of the light. And in that, we are not separate from it, the light being God or the Godhead or whatever people call it. And we're all made of the same energetic material.
Yes, indeed. I've always felt that since you've taken Adolf Hitler as an example here, that he was chosen to lead the German people to disperse, if you like, the negative energy that clearly still remained after World War One. And even as you get missions to lead people into the light, you have to have missions that lead people, if you like, in a manner of speaking, out of the dark. But they still need somebody to lead them and get rid of that energy, to sort of play it out.
That is a really excellent point. That's really, I love that, because when you realize that it's just about energy, that changes the way you look at it. If you don't identify with it within your small little human ego world, you know, that we're all in, we cannot judge any leader. We cannot judge anybody, because everybody is playing a certain role in this movie called an incarnation. And somebody has to play the role of the evil dictator. Somebody has to play the role of the child molester. All of these are, and people who do these roles, all of us, we volunteer for this. And who, imagine a soul that would volunteer to come to Earth and be Adolf Hitler. What is that soul planning? You know, I mean, that's actually a very high calling.
Yes, yes. I have no doubt that they have a great deal of karma to clear, and they possibly clear it by taking that particular place as a leader of that energy. So maybe in a funny way, although you might think they're making their situation worse, they're probably clearing karma by doing it. It's a funny setup, isn't it?
It is a funny setup. It is. It's a strange little contradiction. And a lot of that, too, has to do with how we understand karma. Karma is something that is not good or bad. It's just the movement of energy. And what we do with karma is we balance it. So somebody like Hitler is doing a lot of karma balancing for a lot of people. And that's quite a job to take on, you know, to create such a large movement of energy on Earth, which creates a huge advancement in awareness and consciousness. Somebody has to choose to do that job. And it does balance karma. It makes people aware of atrocities and bigotry and all of these things, and that piece of awareness needed to come to us.
Yes,
and what better way to get it than through tragedy?
Yes, because to learn, we don't always have to be part of that scenario. We can actually be an observer and still learn lessons from it.
Well, and it's interesting timing also about Hitler, because it happened at the time when we had newsreels and movies to actually take pictures of these things, where in other mass atrocities in history, there were no pictures. But people don't realize that this was not the first genocide in human history. You know, the Turks in the Afghanistan took out 10 million people. In when was that, 1900s? I don't know exactly when that was. 10 million. But
yes.
We didn't see pictures of that.
Hmm.
So somehow we don't count that.
Yes. It's exactly the reason you've said, because we can read about it, but it doesn't have the same impression on us.
Yeah, so the timing was kind of perfect, you know, for somebody to say, well, okay, you didn't get it with the Turks, so let's do it again, you know, with the Germans, and this time we'll have pictures
so that you can see
what this is.
If somebody said to you, what's it like to die, because I think that is a great fear. People don't know what to expect, and they maybe think it's going to be painful or whatever. What would you say?
Well, I would say death itself is never painful. Illness and injury is painful. Danny talks about that quite a bit in our book. We have a whole chapter on what it's like to die, and he talks about it to me still now. And actually, my next book, my new book, which is coming out next year, is called Embracing Death, A New Look at Grief, Gratitude, and God. And it's all about that fear of death. The reason we have a fear of death is because it's the ego's fear of disappearance. And if you remember that there are two parts of us, there are many parts, but there's two primary parts of us functioning in physical life. There's our soul, which comes from the higher realms and chooses to incarnate and pretty much knows the whole truth about everything and knows exactly what's going on. And then there's the ego, which is like a cloak that goes over us that's necessary in order to operate a body. And the ego has to be competitive, and it has to be judgmental, and it has to have fear, and it has to have all this stuff that you need in order to live on Earth. So these two things are always at odds with each other, and the soul knows that it can never die, but the ego says, oh my God, I have to fight to live. I have to fight to stay in this body. So it's only the ego part of ourselves that's afraid of death. And if we get in tune with the higher aspects of ourselves, we lose our fear of death. I mean, you can ask any spiritual teacher or person who meditates or anybody who's done any spiritual work if they're afraid of death, and if they've done their work, they will say no.
Right. Now, we haven't come to the end of the program quite, and it's been running along very nicely. So I'd like to give you time to give your website address and where to buy your book. But first, one question. You speak about our power to manifest anything we choose. Can you explain that in a couple of minutes?
Yeah, well, because everything is created by thought form. You know, the universe, the planets, it's all created by thought form. And so everything that we do in our life is created by what our soul is working on in its little workshop. People don't understand manifestation because of, in my opinion, of the book The Secret. I feel really steered people in the wrong direction about manifestation, because it told people that if you're manifesting correctly, you will have a conflict-free life. You'll have money, you'll have love, you'll have the perfect body, you know, you'll have a great gold Cadillac. And so people who are suffering are saying, well, I'm not manifesting properly because I'm still poor and I'm still sick. And what people don't realize is that you are manifesting perfectly, because poverty and sickness is something that your soul is requesting in order for you to learn particular lessons in this incarnation. And so manifestation does not mean that you only manifest happy stuff. Everything is a manifestation and everything is a creation based on our soul seeking of growth.
Yes. And it does tell us that whatever we've lined up in our life plan, we should take it quite seriously, because somewhere in that is a lesson that we've come to learn.
All through it. That's what the whole life plan is for. That's why we're here on Earth.
Yes.
And when we're done and there's nothing else we can learn from earthly life, we'll go move on to some other form in the cosmos and do something else.
Fine. Now, a minute for you to tell us your website address and where your book can be obtained.
You can get my book, A Swan in Heaven, at all the usual places. Amazon is the best place, at the best price, Amazon.com. And my website is afterlifeawareness.com. Easy to remember. And from that website, you'll find links to the various things I do, to my book and my workshops and other useful tidbits. And the book, A Swan in Heaven, is the book about the story of my communication with my son. And the next book is a little more general than that, not quite so focused on my own personal story, more about how all of us can develop this kind of communication, lose our fear of death, and live in a much higher consciousness.
Right, that's lovely. Final words from you. What message would you give our listeners?
My favorite summary message would be that, and I'm sure your listeners already know this, is really simple. This is not all there is. We are not alone. We are not these bodies. You know, this existence is an illusion. It's a stage play that we created so that we would have a platform on which to act out our soul's constant craving for expansion. So just know that it's bigger than all this, and that there are two parts of ourselves. There's our soul and our ego. And whenever you're coming against some sort of conflict or struggle, stop and ask yourself, is this my soul or my ego that is addressing this problem in this way? And another way to look at that is, you know, is this a fear response or a faith response? And the faith response is always to lean on the side of the soul. And when you don't know what your soul wants, go and meditate. Just go and breathe deeply and ask your soul to reveal itself to you. And it will.
Thank you very much, Sari. It's been a wonderful program with you. Thank you very much for your interesting facts and the story of your son's death. It's sad in a way, perhaps, that you had to reach that point through that experience, but we know it hasn't really harmed either of you. Thank you very much. I'll just quickly announce to my listeners that next week I have Stephen Sindoni, who followed through the legend of J.C. Brown. And it's about a guy who in 1904 was said to have found the entrance to an 11-mile tunnel leading under Mount Shasta to the lost civilization of Lemuria. And I can tell you it's a very interesting story. So I hope you can join me, and thank you for being with me today. Thank you very much. God bless you all.